morning, counsel.
May it please the court, Daniel Dorsey on behalf of Mr. Hopkins. Your Honor, the my second issue on the closing arguments, I'll just submit that on the pleadings and just present or discuss any questions you may have on the first argument that I presented in the first issue, in that the case here, Mr. Hopkins was denied his fundamental constitutional right under the Sixth Amendment to his right of retained counsel. Although he does not have the right to have appointed counsel of his choosing, he does have the right, according to the Gonzalez-Lopez case, said in the Supreme Court, that he does have the right to have...
He could have had it here, but for his counsel's, the person he wanted as his counsel's, refusal or inability to appear at the time the case was scheduled. Right? Nobody said you can't have this person represent you. It's just that the person he wanted to represent him said, I can't be ready then. I've got other conflicts for that time. It'll be a year before I'll have a time I can try this case.
He said, yes, Your Honor.
So nobody denied him the right to have his counsel of his choice. The counsel he chose just was not available. Isn't that really what happened?
No, Your Honor. The court never said that he could have Mr. Bellarezo as his counsel. The court said that he could have...
The court didn't say he couldn't.
Excuse me?
The court didn't say he couldn't. If he had been available at that time, is there anything in the record that indicates that he couldn't have had that counsel? If he'd been available, because the court's whole rationale in its ruling was, this case is scheduled for trial, there are other defendants, some of them are in custody, we have a crowded docket, it's an expensive, long case if we had to try it twice, so we're not going to make a move that will cause a delay in the trial. But he didn't express a view as to whether the defendant could have, Mr. Hopkins could have that counsel if the counsel had been ready for trial. Did he? Did the court say?
No, Your Honor. If counsel was available on that particular date, he could be ready for trial. However, that counsel that Hopkins selected, Mr. Bellarezo, was not, or Clennon, neither one of them were available when the court picked the trial date. The trial date was selected when even Hopkins was not present at the time. The trial date was selected with the intention of going to trial.
Where was Hopkins at the time?
Hopkins was, I would assume he's probably in either Atlanta or California at the time.
Yeah. Nobody took him there, did they?
He went there himself, Your Honor.
He was on escape status, right? Or fugitive status, excuse me.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he was not present at the time of the choosing of the trial date because he was a fugitive from justice.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's his fault, right?
Yes, it would be his
fault. Judge Walton didn't run him off with a stick. I mean,
he did
this on his own.
No, he didn't, Your Honor. He chose to not show up for court when he was, may have known that he was supposed to be in court on that time. But, even though, Your Honor, at the time, they did have, in February of 07, they did have 13 of the 14 defendants arrested and arraigned and ready to go to trial when they picked the trial date in May of 07. And thereafter, Hopkins then did say that he, numerous times, that he did not want Clennon, his court-appointed attorney, for his counsel, and expressed that view to the court a number of times, asking the court to let him have his retained counsel. And additionally, Your Honor, at the point that Bellarezo could be ready was March of 09, which roughly was about 6 months from the date of the trial date, and the court could have been available in June. And of the 13 other co-defendants, numerous of them already had pled guilty by that time. By the time they went to trial, they only went to trial with roughly...
Two of them were still in jail pending trial, weren't they?
Yes, Your Honor. And one was on electronic monitoring.
So you'd have three people whose freedom would be... liberty would be restricted either completely or partially for the time convenience or the choice of your counsel, your client, of having a different counsel.
Or they could have severed the case.
Or they could have severed the case.
Yes, Your Honor.
What, a six-week case?
6 weeks, yes, Your Honor.
With how many witnesses?
Your Honor, there was roughly about, there was roughly 17 witnesses that were law enforcement that were available at almost any time. and 8 witnesses that were civilian witnesses. I think only maybe 1 or 2 that were flew in from California.
Thank you.
You know, then I would also point out to the court that this court has thereafter, in a couple other cases, has during the same time frame, this court, the lower court had also had a couple other cases that they extended out for over 1.5 years that were cited in the pleadings. And at this point,
what's our standard of review for what the judge did here?
The standard of review for
decision of the judge
in Burton. Burton's a standard. They have 7. There's roughly about 7 things in there that.
Burton.
There's Burton under U.S. v. Burton.
So isn't it abuse of discretion our standard of review in how those factors are applied?
Yes, Your Honor. It's abuse of discretion, yes, and that in Burton. Your Honor, if you have no further questions at this time, then I'll reserve the rest of it for.
Okay. Seeing none, you can. How much time have you got left?
8 minutes.
Okay, you can reserve. That'll
Thank
be
you.
Fine. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, the standard of review in this case is abuse of discretion. Here, the district court clearly did not abuse its discretion in denying appellant's request to have Mr. Balrazo represent him and replace his very apt and prepared trial attorney at shortly before trial. It's clear the district court has wide latitude to balance the rights of counsel of your choice under the Sixth Amendment against the needs of the fairness of the demands of the court's calendar, which is exactly what the court did here. Here the district court weighed all the Burton factors which are applicable. It articulated its reasons for denying Mr. Hopkins' representation by Mr. Balrazo, articulated everything on the record. It gave both Mr. Clennon, the trial attorney for Mr. Hopkins, and Mr. Hopkins and the government a full hearing as to what the position of the parties was. It made clear on the record that Mr. Clennon was prepared to represent Mr. Hopkins at trial, and having weighed all those factors and weighing heavily the fact that Mr. Hopkins had chosen to become a fugitive, knowing full well that he was wanted after having been told by an FBI agent that there was an arrest warrant for him, and having been told by a defense attorney that there was a warrant for his arrest, he chose to leave the jurisdiction until he was caught approximately 9 months later, before which a trial date was set in this case.
Ms. Kelly, on the trial date question, you say in your brief that the first mutually available time would be late May or early June, but then Hilt's attorney might not be available because of a death case. Although Hilt later pled guilty in denying reconsideration of appellant's motions, the court was likely unavailable for trial until September due to other cases on its calendar. Is that just your speculation?
No, what happened, it was Mr. Hilt was at the first hearing, I believe it was July 13th, when this Mr. Balrazo first came to court and asked to represent Mr. Hopkins. At that point, Mr. Hilt had not yet pled guilty. Mm-hmm. By the time the court had the next full hearing of the issue in, I believe, September, by that point, Mr. Hilt had pled out, and so that took away any problem with Mr. Hilt's attorney being unavailable due to his work on a death penalty case. But by that point, the trial court had already set other matters, and therefore, even if Mr. Balrazo had been available.
I mean, you say the court was likely unavailable, and there's no reference to anything in the record. So what is the basis for that statement?
The court at that point had said that it was unlikely that it would be ready until up to 1 year in the future.
Oh, in September.
In September, he was saying that, well, you know, now that everything else has played out and it's been several months since our last hearing, I now have things set.
So it's the judge's estimate.
It was the judge's estimate of his own calendar at that point. So with the judge's estimate, you're talking about another year of waiting. And in this case, as the court took into consideration, 2 out of the 3 co-defendants of Mr. Hopkins were held without bond. And it's noteworthy that those 2 co-defendants, the charges against them, they were either acquitted of or the charges the jury hung on them. And they were later dismissed. So these were people whose liberty interests were very obviously affected by another. They couldn't have been known at the time.
We can consider that.
No. But it just points out the fact that the co-defendants' liberty interests are really an important factor here.
And at 32 in your brief, you distinguish the Mitchell case on three grounds. The point being that the appellant argues that the government's requested exclusions under the Speedy Trial Act undermine the government's opposition to appellant's request for a continuance. And you then make three statements about Mitchell, but I don't see that any of them is particularly relevant to the point that the appellant is making. Can you explain why this, or tell me if you, what is the government's response to this point by the appellant?
Well, the Speedy Trial Act, it really, that involved two motions by the government seeking exclusions of time, first very shortly after the takedown, to continue the investigation, and information was coming in. Not all the defendants had been arrested at that point.
That was the first one.
The second one, I believe, was in March of 2007, and it was excluding, I'm sorry, it was in May, shortly after the trial date had been set, and they were seeking to exclude the remaining time between that date and the date of trial that had already been set in that case. Our point is, with the Speedy Trial Act, is during that period of time, the defendant remained a fugitive in this case, knowing full well that he was a wanted person, and the fact that the government sought exclusions of time under the Speedy Trial Act, really, it doesn't affect him in the least in this regard.
His point was that it was a complicated case, right?
Well, it was a complicated case.
The government was saying it wanted to exclude this time because of the complexity of the case.
That was one of the reasons was they had mentioned in both their speedy trial motions that it was a complex case.
That complexity of the case is part of his argument for having an allowance of time for his chosen counsel.
Yes, but
and for his attack on the adequacy of appointed counsel.
Well, that's true, but here the point is that he had adequate counsel who was prepared to go to trial. Mr. Clennon never made a motion saying that he needed additional time to get ready for trial.
That only proves his point, doesn't it? inadequate counsel, that was his argument. He doesn't make an ineffective assistance.
He never made an ineffective assistance.
No, I understand that, but he was objecting all along that the counsel was not making motions, the counsel was not preparing, et cetera.
And on the day that trial began, the court had a full hearing where actually the defendant spoke first at length and asked the court not to interrupt him, and then made all his arguments as to why he thought his counsel was unprepared. Mr. Clennon went through point by point and answered each of those problems that his defendant was discussing. And having heard all that, the court said that he believed that Mr. Clennon was indeed prepared for trial. It would have been unreasonable to replace a competent trial-ready attorney with somebody who then needed a year to get prepared and then present the case to court at that point. Mr. Clennon never moved for a continuance, despite the fact that he wasn't appointed until May of 2007. He clearly got ready for trial and got up to speed quickly. And there's no allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel. And I would say that Mr. Clennon's actions at trial bore out the fact that he was indeed prepared for trial. So for those reasons, and we also distinguish Mitchell, too, because that was a case where the defendant wasn't a fugitive, so he hadn't put himself in a position of giving himself less time to get prepared for trial. And in addition, in Mitchell, the government opposed continuance of only a few days for the defendant to find new counsel. Here it's very clear that we're talking months, if not a full year, before you can continue on with trial if counsel who was ready for trial was replaced with Mr. Balrazo. And really the point here is, did the court abuse its discretion?
Did the district court at all rely on Hopkins having been a fugitive?
Yes, the court relied heavily on that, particularly noting that the government had noted that Mr. Balrazo had been in touch with the appellant's family approximately 6 months before, so that they were considering Mr. Balrazo. Certainly Mr. Balrazo at that point, had the defendant come in at that point and given himself up, Mr. Balrazo could have gotten on the trial at that point and had more time to get up to speed, and perhaps the situation Mr. Balrazo found himself in with the current trial that he was in, where they were taking a break, the court in that case could have taken into consideration the fact that Mr. Balrazo had this representation of Hopkins to take care of in September. as well. So the court did consider the fugitivity quite strongly. And the other factors it did considered the fact that cooperating witnesses were held, the co-defendants were held, Mr. Clendon was prepared to represent
him. I didn't see anything in the record that suggested that there was really any inconvenience to witnesses here.
The only point that the government was making was that there were cooperating witnesses who were held awaiting their sentencing and had to testify first before they were sentenced. But the court,
those witnesses were so anxious to be sentenced, and it would have been a problem to have deferred the sentencing?
No, it wouldn't have been a problem to defer the sentencing. That was just another point.
It seemed to me that as a burden factor, that didn't count for anything, really.
It was just something that the government had raised. The court's main concern was with the co-defendants that were held without bond in this case.
Mm-hmm.
The length of the delay, the fugitivity, and the fact that Mr. Hopkins had counsel who was prepared to go to trial at the current trial date. So for all those reasons, given the court's detailed findings on this issue and full hearing, it's clear that the court did not abuse its discretion in this case in not allowing Mr. Balrazo to represent the appellant at trial. And we'd ask that you affirm the decision. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Two arguments I'd like to present to the court, counter to the government. One is that Clendon actually moved to withdraw from the case roughly about a month after he was appointed in the case. And then the other point I'd like to point out is under one of the Burton tests, there's no requirement that Hopkins has to show that Clendon himself was inadequate. He really just has to show under the McGill case that he wanted different counsel than Clendon. So he doesn't have to show that he was inadequate or ineffective. He just needs to show that he didn't want him as his attorney. I think he did that fairly extensively in his pleadings that he filed with the court.
And you don't make any claim that he was inadequate, in fact, right?
No, Your Honor, because Clendon actually, I think his defense was that Hopkins was in a conspiracy, but he wasn't in the conspiracy that the government was alleging that he was in. So I don't see how he could have been ineffective by alleging that defense. It's a difficult defense to put forth, but for him to be ineffective doing a defense like that, there's basically all the evidence comes in, he doesn't object to anything. If there's any other questions with the court, then I'll just submit the rest of my time on the record.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. You were appointed by the court to represent the appellant in this case, and the court thanks you for your service to the courts and to the defendant and to the United States.